Before this morning's attack, we spoke to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. He has directed the U.S. military to victory in two wars, in Afghanistan and Iraq, and now Rumsfeld is dealing with the aftermath of victory.
We also know that there are jihadists who came in from Syria for the most part, but also from some other countries, and are attacking the coalition and Iraqi infrastructure. We're arresting, I'm going to guess, a couple hundred people a week in various parts of that country. And I've asked them to get the interrogations and see if they can't find out who precisely the people are and what kinds of things these different categories of people are. But the truth is, a person who wants to can attack at any time, at any place, using any technique, and it's not possible to defend every place. So as long as you've got Iraqis and others in the country who want to damage pipelines and that type of thing, well, they're going to be able to do it. The damage, of course, is done to the Iraqi people.
Is there now something about the nature of the U.S. occupation that is inspiring recruits to the insurgency or whatever you want to call it?
No, I think there were people who were in favor of Saddam Hussein from the beginning, and they still are. And I think there were jihadists who were anti-U.S. from the beginning. There's nothing peculiar, unusual that's happening that I've been able to determine.
Several current and former U.S. officials have said on NPR in the last few days that they believe that there should have been more planning sooner for the post-war situation in Iraq. Retired General Garner, who was the head of the occupation, retired Lieutenant General Bates, who was the second in command, and Richard Lugar, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, have all suggested that there were efforts within the government to plan for the future of Iraq that were rebuffed, to use Lugar's word.
That is not what General Garner or General Bates said. I am positive they did not say they rebuffed anything, because I've talked to him within the last 7 days on the subject.
Lugar's word was rebuffed.
I understand that.
Lieutenant General
Lugar
Bates said there was a lot of planning agency by agency, but if we could have started the process instead of the third week of February, if we'd started the process in October, then we could have put those plans forward. Bates suggesting that it's too bad that people were not thinking about
Well, there was a good deal of interagency work that was done before General Bates got involved. And General Garner, I've forgotten when I asked him to begin this process, but there had been a good deal of work done interagency over a period of weeks and weeks before that. A lot of the planning that was done, interestingly, was for things that eventually, fortunately, didn't happen. There were plans for the burning of the oil fields, and were prepared for that. There was planning for a major humanitarian crisis, which didn't exist. There was planning as to what would be done in the event that the dams were broken and flooding came in. So there was a good deal of planning. It is never possible to plan perfectly or to plan for everything, as anyone who's ever done a budget in any organization knows. You're looking forward, and you do your best.
General Garner suggested also that some very simple, seemingly simple measures, although they may not have been that simple to execute, could have made a difference. Installing a cell phone network immediately, bringing large generators to Baghdad immediately, that the entire situation in Iraq might be different had you taken those small steps.
Well, General Garner was in charge of that process. I don't think anyone anticipated the fragility of the Baghdad power system.
Moving on now, does the United States military right now have sufficient forces to fight two regional conflicts should they come up, while also continuing to occupy Iraq for the indefinite future?
The Joint Staff does tabletop exercises and studies continuously. And if you consider what we're doing in Iraq as one, the answer to your question is yes.
Different people count the number of brigades committed in different ways, but it is easy to find someone who will say that there are only two or three combat-ready brigades that are not committed in the entire U.S. Army at the moment.
We've got, I think it's something like 130,000 forces in Iraq at the present time, and we have, as you know, well in excess of 1 million people in the armed services of the United States.
You indicated some skepticism toward the idea of expanding the U.S. military a few days ago. Can you give me an idea of whether your thinking has evolved on that point at all?
Oh, it has indeed. I've been spending a good deal of time on the question of the stress on the force and the question of end strength. I listed something like 26 things that we are capable of doing that could relieve stress on the force. For example, we've been told that there are studies that say that there is something in the neighborhood of 300,000 military people who are currently in positions that may not require a military person. Now, some of them it's desirable, but let's say that just 10 or 20 or 30,000 of those could be freed up. That's a large increase in, quote, end strength, if you will.
Is it possible to transform the military while still paying for a number of highly expensive weapons programs from past years? Just to pick an example, two new fighter planes, the F-22 and the Joint Strike Fighter.
Oh, sure. It depends on what you mean by transformation. You don't go from an untransformed state to a transformed state. Transformation is more transforming. It's a process over time. It seems to me, as much as anything, it's people, it's attitude, it's a culture that needs to be embedded into the department. And
I think culture has resisted you to some degree, wouldn't you say?
Oh, it always does. My goodness, change is hard for people. It's the most natural thing in the world for people to not want to change. But I think we have just dramatically vivid lessons from Operation Iraqi Freedom and the war in Afghanistan and the global war on terrorism that this department it's not good enough to be capable of fighting big armies and big navies and big air forces on a slow, ponderous basis. We have to be able to move quickly and have to be agile and have to have a smaller footprint, and we have to be able to deal with the so-called asymmetrical threats, the kind of threats that we're facing with terrorists and terrorist networks. So I think the people in this department understand it and that they're making good progress on it.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld speaking in his office at the Pentagon. To hear the full interview, go to our website at npr.org.